This is the second session of an interview with Dr. Basil Hetzel on the 25th of October 2006, interviewer Rob Lynn. Excuse me. Dr. Hetzel, we were talking about the clinical training at the Royal Adelaide Hospital and why that was important. Who were some of the clinicians who were teaching you as Adelaide Medical School students?
Well, the physicians included Dr. Ray Hone, my father, Dr. Teddy Bear, the surgeons included the names of Jose Lyndon Messant. During the war, there was a shortage of people, and two famous knights came back to teach. Sir Henry Newland and Sir Trent de Crepney actually were teaching in the school, giving lectures. Certainly Sir Trent gave lectures. It was not that easy to keep things going. There's, of course, a number of doctors were in the army and the other services. These retired people were brought back.
Was it hierarchical in the sense that you had the Newlands and the de Crepneys and then the honoraries and then worked your way down, if you like?
Yes. Well, they'd already retired, you see, so they were filling in, so to speak, gaps. They were not sort of engaged in major administration, but they were there to teach the students as clinicians.
Was that a great experience for the students?
Oh, I think so. I recall quite clearly Sir Trent de Crepney lecturing, it rounded out, you know, a diet that was a little bit short of people. So that was a useful addition. The aim was this basic clinical training, and for which I think the school was noted. A tradition of care and teaching at the Royal Adelaide.
Dr. Hetzel, would you say that the University of Adelaide's Medical School had a strong interaction with the wider community in that sense?
No doubt, you know, the links were there with the doctors who were, after all, only part-time. They would do two sessions a week, maybe more, and of course the surgeons would do a bit more than that, two plus their operation time. The board of the Royal Adelaide, of course, had community representatives, and the staff, the honorary staff, had their own society and made inputs to the hospital board as they thought appropriate. Mm-hmm. There's a fine tradition of service at the Royal Adelaide, but it was a big hospital, and it was also, by the time, a bit later on, it really became seriously run down in Tom Playford's time. Tom Playford was interested in industrial development of the state. His own experience of education was somewhat limited, and health and education were on the back burner, so to speak. But there was a crisis which with publicity about the state of the Royal Adelaide, that there were rats running around and so on. And that Tom Playford was, of course, upset to hear that and said, you should have come to me sooner. Well, it wasn't as easy as all that to get to Tom Playford. But the leadership there fell to the new academics like Professor Robson. I think there's a fairly conservative attitude among the senior staff. Would be reluctant to, you know, make a noise about a situation that would reflect badly on the hospital and so on. But the moment did come when that was... Stuart Coburn played a part in that, and that led to the new East Wing and gradual rebuilding of the Royal Adelaide.
Strange to think of that as new now, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, that would have been 1960-something.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Now they're contemplating the buildings are, of course, out of date. They're rebuilding quite a segment that was resident quarters, yeah. Nurses' quarters, and of course that's has modest use, but obviously it should be. I understand it's going to be knocked down and a building more appropriate to the needs of the hospital today put up.
Dr. Hetzel, even though, if you like, the Royal Adelaide campus was removed from the university proper, did you as students still feel very much a part of the university as well?
Oh, I think we did, but the ties with the university were, we weren't spending time in the university any longer. We spent all our time at the hospital. We had lectures, of course, but they were given in the IMVS Lecture Theatre, which is on the campus. So that, in a way, that the links were obviously from the past, but more from the past than the present. Even though, of course, people, professors of pathology were there, who are university professors, but it was all done on the other side of Frome Road, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I do. Yes, I understand that. Next thing I'd like to ask may be a difficult question to answer, I'm not sure of this, but you said that the medical school was very much towards training in general practice. That was the whole purpose, and that was, of course, quite understandable.
Yes.
Were any of you encouraged to go further in research-type medical work?
I think that some were more interested in research than others, of course, in the teachers. Certainly, my father was very interested in research, and I was fortunate to have an opportunity to do a little bit of work before I went to New York. But it was very much an extra, I would say, in the clinical environment. You see, but just beginning, there was an interest in clinical research, but my father, and I think Ray Hone also, possibly confined to them. The clinical pathologist, Eugene McLaughlin, was somewhat interested in research, and of course the special labs would be slowly developing research interest, that is the diagnostic laboratories. So that it really didn't get going. The IMVS, you see, was an Institute of Medical and Veterinary Science that was seen as a place where research could be initiated, but the clinical side didn't develop very much. I had a clinical research appointment at the IMVS before I went to New York, which was rather fortunate.
It's about 1950, would it have been?
Yeah, that was 49 to 51. I went to New York in 51, mid-51, and was there for 3 years till 54. And most people were oriented to practice, most general practice and some specialist practice. And in those days, we're talking about the 40s, so that research, clinical research, even in London, was very modest at that stage compared to what it became.
Now, with that in mind, and your comment that your father was very, and Ray Hone were very much pointed towards the research, would you mind talking a little bit about the scholarship which you were later awarded that came through the Michelle family and that your father was integral in,
yes,
in accessing?
The endowment was from Gwendolyn Michelle Hastings. Hastings was her married name. She was, and you know the Michelle family. She was a patient of my father's, had high blood pressure over a number of years, and he did encourage her to think about, she is single, wealthy woman, think about the possibility of endowment of a medical research fund at the University of Adelaide. And she finally made that initial bequest, I think of $750,000. You could verify that. In the early 50s, probably about 53.
That's a huge amount for that period.
Well, it was. It certainly was. And it was supplemented later. That data, I have seen those figures. The university has listed the medical research bequests it's received, and I've seen that. And I could probably dig it out, and they could tell you. So that was enough to found a scholarship, and it was seen as clinical research. With an interest in the sort of holistic view, and it was exceedingly fortunate for me that it was available by 1955, when I was an applicant, and I don't know how many other applicants there were, but I was appointed and took it up when I got back at the beginning of 56, and I had 3 years at the Royal Adelaide before I went to the Queen Elizabeth as reader and head of the Department of Medicine at the Queen Elizabeth.
Was that still an extension of the university down there?
Oh yes, it was a teaching hospital of the university. See, they were short of beds for teaching, with the numbers of students increasing, very short of beds, and there was a shortage of services in that whole area, which was more lower socioeconomic grouping, and older people, and has since so that hospital, and there's a history of the QEH, as you would know, done,
yes,
by Ian Forbes.
Yes.
So that it was very much set up with university units in it from the beginning, you see, full-time university units, both in medicine and surgery, and obstetrics was also based there.
That's right, of course it was.
And Lloyd Cox was the first professor of obstetrics. Dick Jepson was the first professor of surgery. It started down there, had 2 years there before he came to the Adelaide, and then the reader in surgery went down there, Bernard Catchpole, and I was reader in medicine, in charge of the medical unit from 59. Started in 59, my beds were the first to receive patients down there.
Now, Dr. Hetzel, this is a bit of a tangential question and I'm interrupting, but were Flinders and later Modbury hospitals a bit of an offshoot of what was going on at the Royal Adelaide?
Well, it was much later, you see.
Yeah.
We're talking now, well, it wasn't that much later, I suppose.
It's after you'd gone to Melbourne, I think, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. The Flinders University had started, I think, in...
65?
Yeah, that's what I said, yes. And the medical school came, I suppose, quite soon. Mm. I think they were... I went to Melbourne in 68.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they were, you know, they were making appointments, I guess, by 68.
I didn't mean to divert you from talking about the Queen Liz here, but at the QEH, how were you looked after by the university? What was the relationship like?
Well, you see, we were full-time university staff, and we, the departments were, in other words, university departments, so that they were, we were full-time academics, just like up here, and we had nice new laboratories. I had very nice laboratories down there. For 59, it was a sort of state-of-the-art. And we got going, you see. I had staff. I had a senior lecturer, which was filled for a while with temporary appointments. And then finally, Ian Forbes joined me. And he was a very good research man in immunology. I was interested in endocrinology, the thyroid and the adrenal.
Mm-hmm.
And had graduate students. And so that I was just under 10 years at the QE. It was very demanding, but it was a wonderful period because the young staff who, you know, got their chance were not having to wait for retirements at the Royal Adelaide, and there's a sort of challenge of really outdoing the Royal Adelaide. And indeed, the teaching was much more oriented to the students and student participation. Residents, students got to do more things with their hands, and residents, of course, too. The hospital was an old hospital, pretty authoritarian, and this was a younger staff who were not authoritarian, another generation. So we really, right at the beginning, the climate was established down there, where it was good for students and good for residents. It's interesting how that was a very definite phenomenon. I, of course, had been in the States, and so that there are others that had been, more, you know, more recently. No question, it was always England or Scotland for my father's generation, but for us, it was these other possibilities. And increasingly so, of course, with time. I was probably unusual in going to the States in my grouping, but Don Cheek went to the States, as I explained, and but more research orientation. But the QE was, in that first 10 years, things really ticked. What happened was, you see, then that Flinders, of course, was established with a hospital and medical school, so there's much more competition for funds, Royal Adelaide, Flinders, QE. And the QE had to battle to get funding. And really, politically, with the Liberal government, was sort of allowed to run down. It's a safe Labor seat, The Liberals were not interested. And things had got to really quite a serious loss of morale, which has been alleviated since the Rand Labor government. And they've got quite an active research institute now, and they're pulling in about $15 million a year.
Really?
Yeah.
Serious research?
Yes. They're one, of course, you probably are well aware, the reproductive health unit is based there.
Yeah.
And that unit is now going to move up here.
To the Royal Adelaide, is it?
Yeah, or be Women and Children's, I think.
Oh, okay.
Because it's not inappropriate. They have a private practice facility, don't they, on De Quetteville Terrace? And so the research will be, is moving from the QE to the Women and Children's.
Dr. Hetzel, you mentioned some time ago A.P. Rowe.
Yes.
Was it in your time at the QEH you came to know him, or earlier than that?
A bit earlier. He was here 48 to 58. 10 years. And there's many stories that can be told.
Go right ahead.
You've heard a bit about him. Actually, the doctors got on fairly well with him. He let us start at the beginning. He was an administrator, not well known here. He, I believe he had a BSc London. Of course, he was demonised by great and small in this community. But the story is made up of accident, chance. But it's not generally known. He served with considerable distinction in the war. He ran, a research facility which really was engaged in developing radar. And TRE, it was called. And he had a group of scientists, independent of discipline, bright academic research-oriented people there under him, and they perfected radar. And I have a lecture given by C.P. Snow at Harvard in 1960, in which Rowe is mentioned twice in the footnotes as serving with considerable distinction, but his work was secret and therefore was not known. But he appeared here, as you may know, in transit to Woomera. He was a defence advisor to the Commonwealth Government and was associated with the development of Woomera, and appeared in the Adelaide Club. And the boys were talking, you see, and the university, we're talking now about 47, 48, was in a parlous state, as all of them were in Australia following during the war and after. And they wanted a vice-chancellor, and so somebody obviously got the idea that this rather well-experienced and obviously well-respected administrator could be vice-chancellor of the University of Adelaide. Well, he's offered the job and was appointed in 48. Well, he had nothing to do with universities, really, and proceeded. But he had a very abrasive personality and didn't hesitate to make statements of a very sort of down-to-earth critical statements about various aspects of the university. He made statements like that the professorial board is a collection of mediocrity. I mean, a public statement. And it wasn't long before he aroused the not just ordinary but fairly substantial hatred, particularly in the professorial staff. On the other hand, he had some good ideas. He established the first staff club, which was on the base, the old anatomy school, and he had a flat there. He lived there in one part of that with his wife. He did introduce sabbatical leave. He was involved in the pushing Menzies over the Murray Committee, 57, and had a number of good ideas, but he never seemed to be able to get anybody to work with him because of this personality, very abrasive personality. But the clinicians, strangely enough, including my father, he had respect for, because they were honest men working in the community, as opposed to the academics of a collection of parasites, etc., 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 you see. So this is an explosive situation. And he went on study leave himself in 58, and it was agreed that he would not, you know, return to take up a position. But the professors were linked up in a, could only be called a conspiracy, to make sure he didn't come back as vice chancellor, and they overreacted really. And he, when he came back, was very upset that this had happened, and resigned. I was at his farewell, which was 58 exclusively sub-professorial staff. No professors were there, except for one, a professor of chemical engineering, a man named Spooner, who was quite a rugged individual. I was only talking about him the other day with people that have succeeded him in chemical engineering. He was regarded as his informer. But it is an incredible phenomenon that the farewell was held. There was no professor there.
Was this at the staff club? Or
yes, Russell Matthews was chairing it. He's a reader in commerce or etc.
Like
and so it was a really, I mean, he did quite a certain amount really for the university. It was in a shocking state. The Murray Committee, of course, was very, you know, a very critical step that opened up everything in the, from 1960, Menzies, from 1958. Menzies accepted the findings without reservation about new establishment, etc., and the university. That's how the medical school got a real lift. And I was lucky to be around at the time, you see, so that units could be staffed at the Queen Elizabeth, you see, and so on. I was very fortunate to be there. And he never forgave Adelaide, so to speak. It was made clear that people who visited him from here must never mention the word Adelaide. He finished up teaching, I believe, teaching maths at Malvern College, one of the, you know, public schools in England. And in a sense, tragic. There was a fellow who he was involved in appointing called, oh, the name just hit me, Reader in Medicine and the Humanities. I'll think of it in a second. Good heavens, I don't know. I just lose the thing.
At what point?
Reggie Harris.
Oh.
Does that ring a bell with you?
No, that's one I don't know.
Reggie was quite a colourful character. Had a PhD from Oxford in philosophy, but they advertised this job. I don't think it was financed by Michelle money. I think it was part of the, you know, Reader in Medicine and the Humanities to civilise the medical students, you see. And Reggie Harris was appointed. Who was Reggie Harris? Reggie Harris, I guess he was known to Rowe we met him in the Athenaeum and so on, and said to Rowe, "Do you think I might apply?" And Rowe said, "Yes, you might apply." And he did apply. Well, he was an Oxford graduate, had, I believe, done a doctorate, but in fact was engaged in running the Argentinian railway.
Is this true?
Yes, before the war. And he said, as he said, we ate the Argentinian railway during the war. Of course, this meat going back to Britain. And he was, I don't know what else he did, it would be available to you. But he was appointed, and he came out with a magnificent library of books, which were in the anatomy school. He had a great wall of books made available to students. And I was engaged in sort of rearguard actions. Of course, this is well after my time. We're talking now about the 50s. because, of course, it was controversial that this, you know, should be done. I'm just trying to think whether Rowe, in fact, was the agent in setting it up, but you could check that. I'm not quite sure how it was got the priority it did, because it wouldn't have got through the faculty. I mean, that's a controversial area, as you would understand. But the idea that the students needed a better education, which of course could not really be faulted. And he did a noble job for a number of years and then retired back to England. Reggie Harris.
I've never heard of him or have met him.
C-R-A-S Harris. C-R-A-S
Harris.
Crash.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yes, he'd be there somewhere. Anyway, how did I get onto that? Well, Rowe was associated with that. Whether he initiated, I don't know. I'll just stop with one final observation on Rowe. Not everybody realises that since Rowe, every vice-chancellorial appointment until McWhorr, the president, from within the university.
Baston?
He'd been there, you see, earlier. He was Rowe's assistant for a number of years. He had an Oxford degree. He was running Singapore, the port of Singapore, and then retired here. Nice place to be in Adelaide. And I understand the following is true. He was putting in a bit of time at working a petrol pump, you know, do something to do, and ran into Peter Carmel. Peter Carmel told me this story, who, you know, it transpired that he's an Oxford graduate, and here he was pulling a petrol pump. And Peter said, he said, you could do better than this. He said, you could help with the administration of the university. So he did. He came in as Rowe's assistant, troubleshooter, in times where there was plenty of trouble. And then, as you know, succeeded Rowe. And a person of considerable stature, who was chairman of the Universities Commission, etc., Henry Baston. Well, he was already there, is my point. The only partial exception is Don Stranks, who was professor, went to Melbourne and then came back, you know that. Not until McWhorr, which is, after all, what, 2 years ago? Yeah. Mary O'Kane, of course, was already DVC research, brought in by Robin. Brown. And Brown was DVC research before, with I guess Marchbanks,
yes,
and so on. You'll see.
That's pretty remarkable. What about Vic Edgelo? Did you know him very well?
Yes. Well, Vic, you see, was...
Justin always said he worked for him.
Who said he worked for him?
Henry Bastard said he worked for Vic
Well,
Edgelo.
Well, Edgelo, you see, he was a new boy in the administration when I put my MD thesis in 1948. And he was, of course, there forever. Mm. And, of course, was the storehouse for with the memory of the university. And was a very powerful figure. Vice chancellors come and go, but the registrar goes on forever sort of thing. Mm. And he was... associated with Lincoln College later and was chairman there for a while. I was on the council on and off for some years before and after I went to Melbourne. But Vic, he was a junior chap in 48 and became senior and so on. Eardley was the earlier one, who was a rather odd sort of eccentric sort of fellow, but Vic, I would have no... you know, he was there and became a sort of factotum as a better memory than anybody else. He did lead the fight to redevelop the Elder Hall as the project, what, $1 million project for the centenary of the university. And he was in danger of being knocked down, etc. So, no, Vic... certainly a significant figure.
The way you've been talking this morning, Dr. Hetzel, it seems that through the years that you knew the university, it really wasn't until the late 50s that it began to dramatically change. Would that be fair?
I think that's right. The Murray Committee was a critical step forward for the universities in Australia. I mean, this one, I think, was possibly more short of resources than some of the others. I think Melbourne and Sydney probably had a bit better resources. But they were in a very... they'd had no real recognition, you could say. They were run on a shoestring. They had just a few professors in the medical school, and the clinicians were teaching for honorary teaching. So, you know, the amount of money would be just very limited. no, the Murray Committee was a very critical moment. Clunies Ross was on that committee. Mm. I can't remember who else was on it, but...
that's Ian Clunies Ross?
I remember when they came to visit us. You see, we were in the old IMBS building. This is 57.
Yeah.
And, you know, the old building that had been there, I don't know, I suppose it had been the lab, you see, the lab laboratory, clinical laboratory, hematology, biochemistry, etc. were in that building, which, of course, it was demolished. And the Department of Medicine started in it, and I started in it in 49. So, yes, it's hard to believe what a shoestring it was run on.
Well, finally, sorry about all this, but finally, what led you to actually go to Melbourne to take up the chair at Monash?
Well,
the inaugural chair, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yeah.
I was here, and I was Professor of Medicine in 64. There's several factors. One was that I went in 64, October, I went to New Guinea to look into the problem of goiter and cretinism in New Guinea. I'd been asked to review some work that had been done, and submitted for publication to the journal, and the editor of the journal asked me to look at the papers, which was very interesting. It used a long-acting iodine-containing injection to correct iodine, what was presumed to be iodine deficiency in New Guinea. Well, I won't go into that in great detail, but I was confronted with a developing country and the public health service of a developing country, which is really a very impressive structure. Mm-hmm. People with services extending from village level and on up and so on. Public health was regarded as a sort of rather light option in medicine. It was a Cinderella, not given much recognition during the course. It was really primarily for people who were going out to do clinical work. Ray Southwood was a physician and city medical officer. But this sort of brought home to me a developing country in the public health service. And where the work we did there, as you may know, was quite critical, and we showed for the first time, it proved that the iodine deficiency and the severe deficiency associated with the brain damage could be totally prevented with injection before pregnancy. Point one. Point two, I had been interested in psychosocial aspects and a holistic view, so to speak, you understand, from the beginning, and to some extent had a Christian sort of commitment origin. And the third thing was I was associated with an Australian Council of Churches initiative called Australian Frontier, which was devised as a means for developing work in the community independent of the parish church, directed study and action on community problems with community consultations on. This is the 60s. Australia was very rapidly big migrant input, post-war population explosion, new cities, new suburbs and so on. Rapid development of communities, but they needed more than housing, so to speak. Elizabeth was the classical example. So I was, I went on to this group as a member of the National Committee, chairman of the State Committee, and then I became vice chairman to Sir James Darling in 64, after I went to Monash. I meant 72, after I went to Melbourne. But this opened my eyes to the social aspects of health. And it was really the combination of those experiences that led me to go to Melbourne, apply for the job. It was new, as you say, social and preventive medicine. It wasn't the first chair, but they had one going back some years in Brisbane, the University of Queensland, a newer medical school than Adelaide, my friend Douglas Gordon held, mainly in reference to occupational health. But this was a sort of starting from the beginning, and I knew some of the people at Monash, and in a word, applied, and they had quite a feel, but I'd already been an applicant for the chair of medicine there the year or so before, and some years before, 63, and my good friend Brian Hudson, who's a Melbourne boy, was appointed, which was the right thing. And this was a new thing, as you could understand, and attracted me partly for that reason. That meant that I let clinical medicine go, but one had the opportunity of sort of stating the field and defining it and so on. And the thing that happened very quickly was the media took it up. We started on suicidal behaviour. It was one of the projects, and that aroused a lot of interest. And developed from there, and then I was, of course, we had a new teaching program, but the thing that was different about the job was that it was the media were interested. And that led to me giving the boy lectures in 1971, and then that Penguin book of mine in 74.
Would it be true to say that that book was, I hesitate to use the word, but seminal in the sense that it really was the first of its type?
That is so, Rob. That is so. It sold, it went through to three editions, it sold 40,000 copies. You could say it educated a generation of students in the health field, not only medical students but all the others, and also to some extent teachers. So the Boyer lectures we, of course, distributed throughout the country to all schools and so on. And it's one of the more, you know, gratifying things one has been able to do. I run into people, oh yes, I know you, your book sort of thing, which is rather nice.
Yeah, still on all our shelves, you see.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Hetzel, did you have any future relationship with the University of Adelaide, or was that pretty much it?
That was about it. I was somewhat disappointed, Rob. You see, after just on 8 years at Monash, I came back to this job here, which was on the campus and so on. And I knew people on the campus from before and since. I thought that I would be able to establish quite a definite link with the University of Adelaide, but what is the background? The background is that previous chiefs of the CSIRO division, including Hedley Marston, the famous figure, were basically anti-university. That applied particularly to Marston, who was a leader in the persecution of A.P. Rowe. And then the fellow who followed him was even worse. And there we were, right alongside chemistry and so on.
Yeah.
There's a gulf. And I wasn't really able to bridge that gulf, in spite of having been a professor at the University of Adelaide. But it was a period of low ebb in the medical school, I think it's fair to say. The leadership was not really very... The dean was not interested, and nothing happened. Don Stranks at one point in time told me we would have to leave the university campus altogether because they had to renovate the buildings, and they'd use our place to, you know, hold staff, would vacate a building and then go there. Well, the building was rebuilt. That happened to me towards the end of my time. Things improved at the end with Marchbanks, finally, with my successor. Because we had a review, you see, at the end of my time, which was pretty favourable, but pointed out there was no real relationship to the university. Which is true, and I did go and see Don Stranks finally just before he died, and then with a view to improving the situation. But that was a disappointment, Rob, to me. I gave virtually no teaching. I could have given a few lectures and so on, but it was just, it wasn't, you know, on the horizon. It needed somebody to take it up from the university side, but there wasn't anybody wanting to do that. We're talking about 76, and I did have actually, in spite of that, I had a wonderful 10 years at CSIRO. Led on to, gave me a base from which to develop the international work subsequently, which I was had the first few years with CSIRO. They helped with the administration. Then I came here to the children's, Women and Children's Hospital in the Way building, the old nurse's home.
Yes, yes.
Have been there since 92. But CSIRO, we were an anomaly there. You see, it was a battle. There was a political battle as to whether this... First of all, you see, the division had been there 50 years and could be said to be run down. They'd had big success, but then, of course, what you do afterwards comes up. And it was Frank Fenner who was asked to look at the show and recommend one person, what ought to be done. He said it ought to be switched from sheep to humans, human nutrition. And that was 74, 75. The job was advertised and they weren't quite sure what they wanted. They had a group of candidates. I was referee for a couple. I was asked to comment. But they hadn't really been able to make a decision. Applicants closed. And then I had a friend, Ivan Jarrett, here, whom you may know.
Yes.
A very old friend who came over and said, oh, well, they still haven't made an appointment. He didn't say you ought to apply for it. He'd rang me up. He was over for a meeting on the La Trobe campus and just told me this. And I suddenly thought, well, if they haven't got a suitable candidate, maybe I can be interested. I realised I needed to move from Monash. Mm-hmm. I had a pretty... It was rough pioneering work.
I was going to say, you were there in the period.
Oh, my word. My word. And... so I rang them in Canberra and they said, oh, we'll get something in, which I did, and in due course I was appointed. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a rundown show, but it had resources, and of course they promised much more, which never really materialised. But it was ageing. I had 20 retirements in 4 or 5 years, which I could restart. Mm-hmm. So there was the general public health aspect. Yes, dear.
Can I interrupt you and ask if Rob would like to stay and have a bite of lunch with you?
Hang on, I'll just be there. Yeah, so it was very run down and you were promised much of which little came.
That's right. But it was enthusiasm about it, in Canberra particularly. And I found the atmosphere refreshing, you see, and... it was, in a sense, free of a lot of the politics, I could concentrate on research. I didn't have to worry about teaching. I liked teaching, but I was happy. Given the opportunity, I was prepared to take a full-time research position. So, and that story unfolded, but... Apart from the general public health aspects of nutrition, coronary heart disease, cancer and alcohol and so on, which was the main preoccupation, I wanted to develop a model in the sheep for the iodine deficiency problem. We could really tie up the effect on the brain, which we did. People were still there from the old days, the trace element deficiency work, and not only that, but I was able to establish a monkey marmoset colony. We could work in the primate, you see, close to man. So we, over 10 years, we had a very productive time. And at the end of that time, I'd been involved in research in New Guinea, research here. It was apparent the problem was very significant in numbers. 2 billion at risk of iodine deficiency, according to WHO, in 130 countries, the most common preventable cause of brain damage by this time, having been ignored for many years. So that's when I, with the help of CSIRO, I had a ready-made constitution from a soil research organisation that was quite appropriate, worked out perfectly well for this iodine one. And we got the support from WHO and UNICEF. And then I was appointed executive director. We had scientists around the world who'd already engaged in research, wanting to see something happen. So I set up this NGO with support from Australia and UNICEF initially. And that led on to everything else. So that, see, I finished at CSIRO the end of 1985. So from 86 till this 20 years, I've been really travelling a lot and able to devote myself full time to this problem. Mm. That's the story in a nutshell. And I've retired in April, as I was executive director 10 years, chairman for 6, emeritus chairman for 5, and I'm now a research advisor, a senior advisor, Rob. That's the final exalted status. So so I'm doing odd things.
Well, I'd just like to thank you very much, Dr. Hetzel. Your memories of the university, I'm sure, will be much appreciated. Thank you.
Yes, well, there is a...